I'm going to remind you about the quantum measurement problem before we get started. So way back on the first day, we talked about the orthodox textbook postulates for quantum theory. And we noticed some inconsistencies. So if you apply the collapse postulate to the system, then you find that the system state evolves indeterministically and discontinuously. Whereas if you imagine that the measurement device is modeled dynamically as just another system that's coupled to the system of interest. And then you apply the unitary evolution postulate because that pair of systems is isolated, you find that the pair of them evolve deterministically and continuously. And the question was, how can you reconcile those two things? And then the quantum measurement problem was about how if you apply the measurement as a collapse postulate, then you find at the end of your measurement, your system and your apparatus do have determinate properties, and cats are either alive or dead. Whereas if you take the composite of system and apparatus and whatever it takes to make the system isolated, then the whole thing evolves unitarily, and you get an entangled state which involves both those different macroscopic states in superposition. And because such a state, let's take a look at that a bit more carefully. This is the kind of state you end up with if you start with a superposition, for example, Z up and Z down, apparatus ready. You couple them together, you get this kind of entangled state. And the problem with this is that it's not an eigenstate of the projector onto the apparatus indicating up, and it's not an eigenstate of the projector or the apparatus indicating down. So normally we wouldn't say that the apparatus indicates a definite outcome for this kind of quantum state. It's sort of, Schrodinger's terminology was that it's sort of smeared out between these two options. So that, we talked about the problem with the orthodox interpretation. And then we had a discussion about different ways out. And the one we've been looking at for the last few days has been to deny that the quantum state's complete description of reality and to assume some hidden variables, as we do in de Broglie-Bohm. But another option was to deny that unitary dynamics is indeed the correct universal dynamics for all systems. So one option there, which we discussed, was that maybe there's one kind of dynamics for classical objects, large microscopic objects, and a different kind of dynamics for microscopic quantum objects, and some sort of coupling between the two. And I mentioned that there hasn't really been much success in these kinds of hybrid models where there's an actual cut between classical and quantum. It turns out to be very difficult to couple two dynamics like that. Where there has been more success is in what are called collapse models or dynamical collapse models. And there the idea is that you assume that unitary dynamics is incorrect, and it's replaced with some other dynamics, but that dynamics is universal. So it doesn't matter what kind of system you are, you follow this novel dynamics. So you don't need any notion of a cut to decide what sort of dynamics to apply. Everything follows the same dynamics. So that's what we're talking about today. So the new dynamical evolution law for the quantum state that you need to posit to avoid the quantum measurement problem and the inconsistencies that we saw in the orthodox interpretation, either has to be nonlinear, or it has to be indeterministic, or both. And I'm going to show you examples of each of those sorts of variations. So you need to recover both unitary evolution and the kind of quantum dynamics you see during measurements as special cases of this sort of evolution. So in particular, you want it to be that when you look at microscopic systems, so just a few maybe elementary systems, then they should obey unitary dynamics to a very good approximation because that's what we see in the lab. But if you have macroscopic systems in the sense of having many, many components being highly composite, then it should obey collapse dynamics to good approximation, as we see in the projection postulate of the standard interpretation, the standard formalism. So the motivations that people have for following this sort of approach are first to achieve a realist interpretation of quantum mechanics rather than just operationalism, to ensure that it's possible to still say that psi is a complete description of reality. So to avoid hidden variables, this is one way of avoiding introducing hidden variables. And finally, unlike these hybrid models, there's no cups, so you don't have to say what an observer is and what a system is. It's a universal dynamics that applies to everything. So and realists tend to like this sort of thing. If the cut was between observer and system, you'd have to have a notion of observer somehow in your postulates. That's the sort of thing that a realist wants to avoid. Okay, so first case, this is not going to take much time, would be modifications which are nonlinear, the nonlinear alternative to unitary dynamics, but deterministic. So the idea here would be that although if the spin is up and your detector is ready, your detector registers up, and it spins down, your detector is ready, and the detector registers down, it is not the case that if your spin is a superposition of these guys, it evolves the superposition. So if it's linear, of course, then this would have to be true. But if you have nonlinearity, then it doesn't have to evolve that. So you can hope to avoid this kind of Schrodinger cat-like state. So the idea would be that this state over here evolves to something like this. The spin is up and the apparatus indicates up. Or it evolves to something like this, where these two states here, which it is, could depend on things like the coefficients in the superposition, the particular state of the apparatus, and so forth. But you know, there'll be some non-unitary dynamics that specifies precisely which it is, following deterministically from the details of the initial state. And the indeterminism we see in measurement outcomes in this sort of approach would just be subjective indeterminism, not knowing all the details of the values of these coefficients or the state of the apparatus is what means that you can't predict which of these two outcomes will occur, even though according to the nonlinear dynamics there's some deterministic one of those guys. So turns out that these sorts of approaches were tried briefly. So I know of a few papers in the 70s that tried this sort of thing, but they have all kinds of problems. So as soon as you introduce an evolution that's nonlinear in the quantum state, you get all sorts of predictions that deviate from quantum theory. So you can typically use this to send signals faster than the speed of light. You can use it to discriminate non-orthogonal quantum states. So there's an evolution that takes you from two states that are non-orthogonal to two states that are orthogonal, and then you can do a measurement on those. You can clone, you can do all the things that in the first week we sort of saw were impossible according to quantum theory. For most kinds of nonlinearities you might introduce. So most of the ways you might think of trying to achieve this also imply deviations from the predictions of quantum theory. And to my knowledge, no one has ever come up with a scheme which could reproduce the prediction of quantum theory to good approximation in some limit and achieve a resolution of the measurement problem in this sort of way. So there hasn't really been any success for these kinds of dynamical collapse models, so far as I know. The ones that have been more successful are the ones that are linear in the quantum state, but they're indeterministic. Okay, so the final state now isn't going to depend, is not going to be completely fixed by what the initial state was. So the idea now is that this quantum state, we would like to have evolve indeterministically to one of these two guys, this guy with probability a squared, this guy with probability b squared. So clearly it's no longer a unitary evolution because unitary evolution is deterministic. But we can still imagine that it might be a linear evolution. So if I have a coherent superposition of two states, the kinds of probabilistic evolutions that follow from that might just be a linear combination. I think that'll become clearer when I show you the details of how the model works. So there's two sorts of issues that you have to resolve if this is the kind of approach you want to take. The first is called the preferred decomposition issue. So you want to know what should a quantum state like this collapse to? What basis of states should it evolve into? So there's lots of different bases of Hilbert space. And I can imagine an indeterministic dynamics that would take me to one element of some basis, but you need to specify which basis it is. So you have lots of choices of ways of modifying unitary evolution. And remember, the idea of these sorts of approaches is that we're thinking of measurements as just other collections of physical systems. So there's nothing special about a measurement device. So you need a universal prescription for how atoms evolve. And the way measurement devices evolve should follow from, you know, whatever your dynamics prescribes for atoms and other fundamental entities. So you need to figure out a prescription for, you know, how to figure out what basis that things collapse into, such that ultimately you solve a measurement problem in a satisfying way. That's the first problem. The second problem is sometimes called the trigger issue, and it's sort of a question of, you know, when do collapses occur? You know, how do they occur? What's the mechanism? You know, do they, you know, collapse all the time or just occasionally? That sort of issue. Good. So I'm going to tell you in detail about one of these models. I'll tell you a little bit about another model later, but this is the first model that had any real success. It's the easiest to explain. It captures all the essential features of an analytical collapse model. It was proposed by Girardi, Rimini, and Weber in 1985. And the idea is that at most times, the evolution of the wave function is just given by the Schrodinger equation. Excuse me. So I'm going to, again, here assume that we just have n particles, like I was doing for Bowman mechanics. I'm going to describe the theory for the situation where we just have n non-relativistic particles. So most of the time, we evolve according to the Schrodinger equation. But every once in a while, so every time tau, on average, one of these particles undergoes a different dynamics. Okay, so given that there are n particles, it means one of these n particles undergoes a different dynamics every tau over n period. And the new dynamics now says that the wave function psi should evolve in this way. So I multiply it by a Gaussian. So this is just a Gaussian in R centered at qk with width sigma. So the kth particle in this set, Rk, gets multiplied by a Gaussian centered here. And then the whole wave function gets renormalized. So I have to divide by some factor. And that factor is just the integral of j times psi mod squared. So if you just think, you know, what do I need to make this factor in order for this wave function to be normalized? Well, clearly mod squared of this has to integrate to 1. So that tells you that p has to be this. Good. So if you now ask, right, what's the probability of it collapsing to a particular position, particular qk, the model, the proposal says that this qk should be chosen just by sampling at random from this distribution pqk. And k, which particle collapses, is just chosen uniformly at random. So if you think about the shape of this distribution, it's basically a convolution with psi squared, right? So you're multiplying psi squared by a Gaussian of some width sigma. And so if that is, you know, narrow compared to the support of this guy, this distribution is, this probability is high wherever psi has high amplitude, and it's low where psi has low amplitude. So it's more likely to find to have a collapse occur in regions where the amplitude, when I integrate over all variables except Rk, I get a large probability for the wave function. So if I just calculated the probability of finding a particle at position Rk for this wave function, okay, that's quite close to this probability distribution. I just have to convolute it by this Gaussian factor to get this probability distribution. So it's sort of what you'd expect, that it says, oh, collapses are going to occur in places where the wave function has larger amplitude. Yes?
What's that sigma?
So sigma, in this approach, is basically a new parameter. It's like, consider it as a new fundamental constant for this model. So proponents of collapse models say, well, it could be that we could understand the values of sigma and tau by some deeper theory. But for the moment, we should think of them in the context of this theory as just new fundamental constants of nature. And they're chosen as follows. So tau, which remember is the amount of time on average it takes for a single particle to collapse in this model, So tau is taken to be about 10 to the 15 seconds, which works out, about 100 million years. So if you've got a single particle in an interferometer in your lab, and you're looking to see it collapse, you'll have to wait a long time, according to this model. So everything you observe in the lab should be consistent with unitary dynamics, because it's unlikely that you'll ever see a collapse occur for a single particle. The sigma, the width, to answer your question, is chosen in these models to be about 10 to the minus 7 meters, so 10th of a micron, which is about the size of a large molecule. And the idea is that we need to make sure that things like apparatus pointers and Schrodinger cats end up appearing localized. And for our purposes, this is small enough. Everything we observed is only verified to be localized at a scale that's larger than this one. So that's sufficient. I'll talk a little bit later about why these two values of the parameters, there are reasons not to make them much smaller or much bigger. And we'll come to that. Okay, so this in one slide is basically the whole theory, right? These are the postulates. And I'm going to talk about what the consequences of this are and why it helps you to solve the measurement problem. But let me just pause and ask whether there's any questions about what is being said here, what the theory is. Yes?
It's a question more about fundamental constants.
Okay.
Is there some fundamental reason for them to have these values rather than others? Would there be some reason why the mean time of collapse for one particle has to be so big?
Well,
you could imagine
if you made it very small, suppose you made it very small, say with nanoseconds, then according to this model, any attempt to do a double slit interference experiment or Mach-Zehnder interferometer interference experiment should find that your interference is highly degraded because your particles aren't evolving unitarily. They're constantly being collapsed in a fuzzy position basis. And therefore, as they get far apart, I should lose the coherence between those two terms of the wave function, and I shouldn't see interference. So if I made it too small, it would be ruled out by existing experiments. And then the other side of it is that if you make it too long, I'm going to show you how this solves the measurement problem. If you make it too long, then it no longer solves the measurement problem for you. Schrodinger's cats would be in superpositions of alive and dead for too long if it was much longer than this. Yes?
Is this convolution causing the momentum of particles?
Is it what?
The convolution, yes. Is it making the momentum fuzzy as well?
Is it making the momentum fuzzy? It is changing the profile of the wave function, and so the probability distribution of momentum is also changing, just because it's Fourier transform. So one thing you can say about this new dynamics is that it doesn't conserve energy. When one of these collapses happens, let's say I had a wave function that was very spread out, it had hardly any features in it, so it had very low kinetic energy. Kinetic energy goes like the gradient to wave function, and then I localize it. Now it has much more kinetic energy. So this collapse process clearly violates energy conservation. And that's just part of the model. They say energy conservation doesn't hold on average. And over time, the energy is going up. Now if you calculate how quickly it's going up, because of these parameters, you find that it's an incredibly small heating, which is extremely difficult to detect. So again, experiment doesn't rule it out, the fact that the universe is heating up very slowly according to this model.
Question. Mm-hmm. So is this non-deterministic?
That's right, this is non-deterministic. So that's here, they say, when they say K is chosen at random and QK is sampled at random from QK, randomness here means not subjective knowledge, you just don't know. But rather here, the idea is that there's nothing in the world that determines which it's going to be. It's just objectively random. Now again, you might say, perhaps there's a deeper theory which could explain this randomness by something else, which you don't know. But that's not the proposal here. That would be a different proposal.
Uh,
What about the spin space and that? Do they collapse?
Yeah, so so here I haven't incorporated any spin degrees of freedom. But you could do that and just keep your collapses being, you know, relating to the spatial degrees of freedom. And then you would find, for example, that if you're in your Stern-Gerlach experiment, for instance, where you're trying to measure the spin, you know, you tend to use position. If the beam goes up, it would spin up. If the beam goes down, it would spin down. The apparatus responds by going to two different spatial configurations depending on what it is. So it's just as in Bohmian mechanics, it tended to be sufficient for things to have well-defined positions in order to recover what we see. Similarly here, as long as things get collapsed along the position basis, that tends to be sufficient. And the spin degrees of freedom will influence how the wave function evolves, of course. And so that will influence what sorts of positions we end up seeing when macroscopic systems get collapsed. So it's very similar to the Bohmian theory, Bell's version of spin. It doesn't itself undergo collapses, but the effects of spin are seen in the spatial degrees of freedom.
Something else?
Yeah.
I think it decreases entropy as well.
Decreases entropy. Why you say that?
Because we have, for example, we have a wave function which is spread out, and then it collapses.
So it's true that if you calculated the entropy associated with, for example, the classical probability distribution over position, that's defined by the wave function squared, then if you localize, your entropy for that distribution will go down. But typically, in quantum theory, we're more interested in the von Neumann entropy, which is trace of the density operator, rho log rho, where rho is the density operator. And because here everything is just a pure state, so this is a pure state evolving to a pure state, the von Neumann entropy is zero, and afterwards it's still zero. So in that sense, it conserves entropy. Of course, when you take into account the fact that you don't know which outcome has occurred, right? So maybe you read your apparatus and you get some knowledge. But suppose you haven't looked at things, and you just know that these systems have been evolving, there's many of them, so they're undergoing collapses, then in general, your amount of knowledge about the system will decrease. So you'll have to average now over the possibilities for the final pure state, average over qk and k, and that means that your description is becoming more and more mixed. So you might have had perfect knowledge of the initial state psi, and then you let it evolve, and you don't know what's happened, it's undergone some collapses, those are objectively stochastic, therefore you don't know anything about them a priori, therefore the state gets more and more mixed. So in that sense, even the von Neumann entropy is going to increase if you're not gathering data. Other questions? Okay, let me point out that there's another way of formulating this theory which will make it look a bit more familiar, given what we did in the first week. So I can always think of this, I can write things in the Dirac notation. So on the previous slide, I'll just go back to it, I was writing everything in the coordinate representation. But I could do it in Dirac notation if I want. So I'll just have cat psi. And then I can think of this collapse step as multiplying psi by some positive operator, which is defined this way. So it's square root of ek, where ek is now an integral over the position eigenstates with this Gaussian profile. So it's the square of that j that we saw back here. So if I just put j squared into this integral, that's the positive operator I'm referring to. And the pqks are just the expectation value of this positive operator. So does this look familiar at all? What is it? I'm not suggesting that this particular Gaussian profile looks familiar, but you have here a positive operator. The probability, it's labeled by qk. The probability of qk is given by the expectation value of that positive operator for the state psi, and the state is evolving by multiplying that vector by square root of that positive operator.
P of m.
Yes. So you can think of this as a POVM, the outcomes of which have a continuous label. So we didn't really see that in the first week. All the POVMs we were dealing with had discrete outcome spaces. But you can also define POVMs for continuous outcome spaces. And so if I choose my normalization constant appropriately, these can be a set of of positive operators such that if I integrate over qk and I sum over k, they go to identity on the space. And so I can think of this as, so in this context, it doesn't have anything to do with measurement, but this is the same sort of set of operators that could appear in a fuzzy measurement of position. So there are measurements of position that tell you everything there is to know about position, and then there are other measurements of position that are kind of noisy. So if this is my positive operator, and it's not a delta function here, if this width is not arbitrarily narrow, then it's not a position eigenstate that you're projecting onto. But nonetheless, you're getting some information about position when you do such a measurement. So it's a fuzzy measurement of position. And we spoke a little bit, and I think you saw in your homework assignments, that the analog of the von Neumann projection postulate for POVMs is often taken to be the square root of the POVM element acting on the state. So this is how states would evolve under a measurement of that POVM when you get the particular outcome qk. So you can think, if you want, of the collapse dynamics as being similar to what would happen if you were to occasionally do a noisy position measurement on a given particle. So you choose a particle at random, you do a noisy position measurement on it, it updates. That's the effect of this dynamics. But for the collapse theorist, this isn't a measurement. This is just a fundamental dynamical process that happens to the particle. Maybe it looks a little bit more familiar if I write it in terms of the density operator. So rather than writing it in terms of psi here, just take the outer product of psi with itself, then you have a root ek on both sides. So rho evolves to root ek, rho root ek, divided by trace of ek rho. So then it maybe looks a bit more like these von Neumann, the generalization of the von Neumann projection postulate for POVMs. And if you don't know what k and qk are, then the effect of evolution is just, you know, weight this kind of collapse with the probability that with which it occurs, and then you just integrate over all the possibilities for k and for qk, and you get this kind of map. So this is the map which just describes, you know, what happens to the system if you don't register, if you don't look at it, if you don't find out where it is. And it becomes more and more mixed over time. So if it starts out pure, this kind of evolution will cause it to become more mixed, just as if I were to do fuzzy position measurements on a system over time, it would become more mixed. Okay, I'll come back to this when I'm talking about some of the criticisms of this approach. And I haven't said this, but remember that the general form for a trace preserving completely positive linear map, that was the most general kind of dynamics we have in operational quantum theory, was this Krauss decomposition form, which is just a sum of linear operators, rho, and the dagger of that linear operator, where this holds. And so this kind of evolution has that form. So it's not as if it's a kind of dynamics that we haven't seen already in the course. It is something that we've seen already. It's just that rather than being postulated as something that's due to coupling to another system or doing a measurement on the system, here it's postulated as an alternative to unitary dynamics when a system is isolated, right? So it's just a modification to what the fundamental dynamics of quantum theory is. But it's of the same form that we've seen already, which is good, because you'll remember that you know, I set out some axioms that you would want any kind of general dynamics to satisfy. It should take positive operators to positive operators, for example. It should preserve the trace, so that if you have a trace one operator, it's a trace one operator afterwards. And it should be completely positive, because if I have two systems that are entangled and I acted on this guy, what comes out the other end should also be a positive operator. So it's a good thing that this dynamics has these properties, because otherwise it might lead to negative probabilities and inconsistency. Okay, so let me start to tell you why this approach solves the measurement problem, because that's what the motivation for introducing it. So say you just have a single particle, and it happens to be in this quantum state here. So there's some Gaussian-like wave packets, phi A and phi B, located here and here, respectively. And it's in a coherent superposition of them with some weights. All right, so the collapse theory says that if you wait long enough, eventually this thing will collapse. And it will collapse to a position, Q, which is chosen by convoluting a narrow Gaussian with this distribution. So it's more likely to be here than it is here. It's also a bit less likely to be here, but much more likely than being way out here. So let's suppose that Q happens to be somewhere here. And then the state, the wave function after the collapse, is just multiply this guy by the Gaussian, and you get something which is close to a Gaussian, but now located over here. What I'm drawing here is multiplying by the Gaussian, that's this guy, and then what you get is this. So this should be a slightly distorted version of this Gaussian, because this isn't quite flat here. So that's the dynamics. I just have a new state, which is more localized than I had before. The interesting thing is when you consider two particles now. So say you have one of these entangled states. So phi A and phi B are as before, but now I have a second particle, which I'm drawing along this axis here, and it's entangled with the first one, and basically there's two wave functions, chi A and chi B for this particle, which I'm going to take to be localized down, chi A is localized down near the origin, chi B is localized up here. Again, let's take this to be guess in packets. And so this entangled state, when I draw it, is going to have a peak down here, that's the phi A, chi A peak, and a peak over here, the phi B, chi B peak. And now ask, what happens if the second particle collapses? So suppose Q2 is the position it collapses to. That's drawn at random from this doubly peak distribution along X2. So it's likely to be somewhere maybe in the first peak. So suppose it collapses there. Well, the final state now is going to be narrow along X2. It's going to be basically the product of these guys here. So it's going to have very low amplitude out here. But the thing is that the profile over X1 is going to change as well, because once I damp things by multiplying something that's very small in X2, it damps this whole peak. Right? So now if I look at the profile along X1, it basically just has this peak down here near the origin and essentially nothing out here. So the point is that it was sufficient to collapse one of the two particles to change the profile of the reduced density operator for both particles. Right? And it's because of the correlations in this wave function. It's a lot like all those steering examples you were doing where you collapse the system over here by doing a measurement, and you find that the distance system collapses to a pure state depending on what outcome you've got. And so similarly here, you do a measurement of position on one of these two systems, and the other system becomes localized as a result of that. So the point is that although you have just one hit, one collapse, the wave function is localized in both coordinates. And that's going to be the critical thing. So we're now back to something that looks a lot like a product state. It's not perfectly a product state, because there might be some very small amplitude of this second peak still being here, but it's close to one. Question? No. So first, let me make before I move on to the measurement problem, let me just note that this is a failure of local causality, what I've just described to you. Because remember, psi in this approach is a complete description of reality. There's nothing else. And if the collapse on one system leads to a localization of a distant system, well, that's a change in the reality of the distant system that depends on where the collapse occurred over here. So it's a failure of local causality. And of course, we know from Bell's theorem that any realist interpretation is going to fail to be locally causal somehow. So it's not so surprising that we see it explicitly in this model, just as we saw it in Bohming mechanics. All right, onto the measurement problem. So remember, this is the setup. We have a Stern-Gerlach apparatus. I imagine that the outcome is triggers a pointer either indicating up or indicating down, for instance. So let's take this to be a macroscopic pointer. And now the whole wave function for the system plus the apparatus plus the pointer, that all evolves unitarily according to orthodox quantum mechanics, and it goes into this entangled state. where phi A and phi B are, say, the two spatial degrees of freedom of this spin. And R2 to Rm will be, you know, particles in the apparatus and the pointer. There's lots of them. And they're going to go into one of two wave functions, depending on whether the particle emerged at the top or at the bottom of the apparatus. And this, of course, is the, you know, kind of Schrodinger cat state that usually causes problems. Now, just as we saw in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, typically these wave functions aren't going to have much spatial support, even for just one of the particles. If I look at their overlaps, they tend to be disjoint in the position space of the kth particle. And that's going to be important for this collapse theory as well. So if one particle is hit, let's say just the kth particle of the apparatus is localized, well, if this is true, so, you know, imagine that there are two, say, gas and wave packets separated in space, you know, it's, say, a particle in the pointer, and it's either a wave packet centered here or a wave packet centered here. If it gets localized to within a tenth of a micron, then it completely damps one of these terms. And everything, the whole wave function, changes by virtue of that one particle being collapsed. And I get essentially just one term left over. And if you say, well, what's the probability that it's going to be collapsed to this term or that term? Well, again, if you think, what's the probability of locating the kth particle at qk? It was just given by the slight smearing of the quantum probability for actually measuring the particle to be at qk. So if you ask, you know, what would be the probabilities of finding a particle in the pointer to be over here or finding it over here, you know, quantum mechanics would just predict those probabilities are a squared and b squared. So in the collapse theory, those probabilities are also going to come out to be roughly a squared and b squared because of the way the qks are chosen. And so what we're going to find is that the whole wave function, so psi prime is the wave function after the collapse, is going to be this product state, maybe plus some negligible terms because the amplitude hasn't totally gone to zero. But it'll be essentially this kind of term with probability a squared, and essentially this kind of term with probability b squared. And so we, you know, have solved the measurement problem. That's the kind of thing that orthodox quantum mechanics says ought to happen. It's the kind of thing that we use to make successful predictions about what sequences of measurements we'll find. Now, if you have, say, 10 to the 20 particles in your apparatus or your pointer, and you ask, how quickly is this collapse process going to occur? Only one of those particles has to collapse. That's the key, that's the beauty of this approach. You don't have to collapse all of them. One is enough to reduce you to one of these terms. So if you've got 10 to the 20 particles there, and one collapse is sufficient to localize the whole wave function, well, the fact that every one of them only collapses every 10 to 15 seconds is not so important, because at least one of them will collapse every 10 to the minus 5 seconds. So what you expect is that for a macroscopic object, the collapse of the whole wave function, when it starts out in one of these entangled states, is going to happen very rapidly. That's exactly the kind of thing you wanted, right? For a single particle in an interference experiment, or a few particles, you know, the collapses are going to occur so infrequently that it'll look just like unitary dynamics. But as soon as you couple it into 10 to the 20 degrees of freedom in some sort of entangled state, now the collapses that really change what's going on occur very rapidly. And so you have you never see Schrodinger cats in superpositions of alive plus dead, because as soon as they go into one of those superpositions, one of their constituents will likely collapse, and it'll go back to being just one of the terms. Yes?
So you're assuming that every single one of those 10 to the 20 particles is spatially disjoint within a tenth of a micron.
That's right. So if in my example, you know, there's, you know, all the particles that are in this pointer, all the particles in this pointer are certainly spatially disjoint. You might say, oh, there's some particles down here that aren't spatially disjoint. But, you know, when you're dealing with numbers like 10 to the 20, you know, it doesn't matter, really. You know, as long as these things are having an Avogadro's number worth of components, you know, this collapse is going to occur incredibly quickly.
So what if you isolate some system that's kind of not too big and not too small, so that the collapse could happen on, like, a few seconds scale?
Mm-hmm.
Can you actually experimentally test that?
I'll talk about the difficulty of experimentally testing this. Actually, that might be the next slide. I'm not Let's see. Why don't I talk about that now? Well, let me ask, are there other questions about this resolution of the measurement problem? Or comments on whether it's a plausible answer to the problem?
Mm-hmm. Shouldn't the particles be entangled so that this collapse happens?
Which particle?
That huge system. In this case, these.
Well, if the simplest case to imagine would be something where I have n particles, which are the superposition of all being here or all being there, and then if I just collapse one of them, they all collapse to
mm-hmm.
being here or being there. In more complicated scenarios, I might have some degrees of freedom that aren't spatially disjoint in this big superposition. But all I really need is for at some point, down the line, as I amplify this quantum signal up to a macroscopic scale so I can read it out, at some point, the information about which outcome occurred has to be encoded in a large number of degrees of freedom which differ in their spatial configuration. And as long as that's satisfied, the collapse theorist will be able to argue that in a very short order, the wave functions can evolve to just one of the two terms. So it's similar to what the Bohmians needed. They needed for the two terms of a superposition to be spatially disjoint, so that only one of the two terms was an occupied wave, and the other term was empty. And they needed it to be difficult to re-interfere those two terms. Here, you ensure that there's no re-interference because after a short time, it's collapsed and the other term's gone. It has zero amplitude, so there's no chance of re-interference. Here, decoherence plays a slightly different role. A decoherence, which is the coupling of many, many more degrees of freedom to this particle, it plays the role of making sure that there's enough degrees of freedom that encode this distinction in a spatial way so that collapses can occur quickly. Right? So decoherence, again, is important here because I need to make sure that this information is redundantly encoded. And coupling to an environment is a great way of getting a very quick redundant encoding. If I have a mesoscopic sized pointer, but there's light scattering off of it and all sorts of other things, then very quickly, many, many degrees of freedom down the line, things that are interacting with the light or the air in the room will pick up information about which of the two options it was. And if one of them collapses, then the whole wave function collapses. Yes?
You were saying here again that the preferred decomposition is where the macroscopic degrees of freedom are just kind of just your support.
Yeah. So here they haven't put in a preferred decomposition, for the total Hilbert space by hand. In a sense, the choice of preferred decomposition came back in the commitment to projecting into this noisy position basis. So in a sense, they were sort of encoding a preference for position, and they're relying on the fact that macroscopic outcomes do tend to differ in the spatial locations of things. So, they basically solve the preferred basis problem by just saying by fiat it's fuzzy position, and then proving that in scenarios that we care about, like measurements, that's sufficient. That's going to get us the results we want, where one of the two terms comes out as the final state. There are, I believe there are some other collapse models that do things a little bit differently. So I think there are collapse models that look at field operators, and they take that to be the preferred basis. You might collapse to having different mass densities. It's like a mass density operator, and that's your collapse basis. But it's roughly the same. All these proposals tend to rely on position. Okay, so what about these parameters? So we mentioned before that if tau was too small, then microscopic objects would not be seen to obey unitary dynamics, and so this proposal would be ruled out by experiment. But now we see why tau can't be too big either, because we relied on the fact that you have 10 to the 20, maybe, systems, any one of which collapses will cause an effective collapse. So if that time scale were 10 to the 30 or 10 to the 100, well, then the time we'd have to wait even for macroscopic objects to collapse would be very, very long. And again, we would say that the model would no longer solve a measurement problem. It would say that Schrodinger cat states should persist for a long period of time. So there's a region sort of in between the experimental bounds that are set on small systems evolving coherently and the size of systems that we tend to see as well localized. And so tau has to be between those two bounds. And then if you look at sigma, so remember sigma was the width of the Gaussian that induces the collapses. So if it's too big, like if it were meters long, then I would expect to find Schrodinger cat states wherein I had coherent superpositions of two things that are macroscopically distinct. Like my pointer would stay in a superposition of indicating two different directions because the Gaussian wouldn't localize it to one of those two. So you want to have something, this is all according to the class theorists, you want to have something that makes sure that things appear localized to us. And so something like a tenth of a micron is sufficient for that. But if you made it too small, then remembering that every time you localize something, you add a bit of energy, right? Because you've increased its kinetic energy. If you made it much, much smaller, then you would have excessive heating, and you start to be able to detect that in your experiments. So there are some bounds on how much anomalous heating there could be arising from collapses. And so you have to make sure that this thing doesn't violate those experimental bounds. OK, so what is the experimental status of these sorts of things? Can we rule out this model? That was the question we had just a minute ago. It's very hard to rule these things out. And the reason is that if I want to prepare a large number of systems so that I can get this time scale for collapse down to something that's experimentally measurable, like, say, seconds, so I need a large, large number of systems to do that. And as soon as I have that many systems, it becomes incredibly hard to isolate them all from their environment. I need to be able to have a scenario where I have n systems that would evolve unitarily were it not for this collapse mechanism. But that means that I actually, to have something where they would evolve unitarily, I really need to make sure that there's no environmental interactions. Because if there's any genuine interactions with the environment, then of course that thing's not going to evolve unitarily. But it won't be due to some collapse mechanism. It'll just be due to quantum mechanics and the fact that it's coupled to this other system. So it's extremely hard to isolate large systems from their environments. And like building a quantum computer is hard for that reason. If we could build a quantum computer with a huge number of qubits in it, then we could start testing collapse theories. But we're far away from doing that sort of thing. So it's a real challenge to test them directly in terms of seeing this collapse mechanism occurring for a large number of particles. I mean, if you go to a small number of particles, the problem, of course, is that you expect it to almost never occur. And then again, it's indistinguishable from occasionally having some stray interaction with an environment and losing coherence that way. And then the second thing is that it's this amount of heating that occurs in the theory is very low, and it's also difficult to detect that. So if you think about an atom, this localization process will add energy to, say, the electron, and it will increase the rate at which this thing will just spontaneously ionize, because you've added some energy to the electron, so there's a probability that the atom will be ionized. So you might expect to see that if, occasionally atoms will ionize, but at a rate that is anomalous. It's not accounted for by your best account of what the environmental interactions are and what's going on. And then you might say, aha, that ionization shows that there's some anomalous heating, and it provides evidence for collapse models. So I know of some people who are working on collapse theories who've looked, for example, at the data from the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, where they're also looking for ionizations due to neutrinos, and wondering whether you could take that data and put a bound on how much anomalous heating there might be, and therefore a bound on you know, some of these parameters in a collapse model. Questions about that? Yes.
But like there are experiments that have Bose Einstein condensates and
yep.
like ion traps, and those
yep.
have some large numbers of molecules in it.
They do. Unfortunately, although those are experiments where you have, you know, quote, a macroscopic number of systems behaving quantum mechanically, it's not the kind of Schrodinger cat state we need. So in second quantized notation, those sorts of experiments tend to be something like, you know, the creation operator for the single particle wave function phi r to the power n acting on the vacuum. So you have n particles all in the same single particle wave function, which if I wrote it out just in terms of the wave function, the symmetrized wave function for those guys, it's just phi r1, phi r2, dot, 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 phi rn, and that's a product state. So it doesn't have the entanglement you need to see this collapse mechanism. Of course, as I say, even if you could prepare something like this product state plus a second product state with chi's here, right? So you'd have, say, 1 over root 2 this state plus 1 over root 2 another product state. Suppose that you could do that experiment. So then people have proposals for how you might try to move towards such a Schrodinger cat state for large number of particles. Even if you could do that, it would be extremely hard to isolate it from its environment, so it would decohere incredibly quickly, and so it would be very hard to test whether you have some of this anomalous decoherence happening. I think Tony Leggett has also made similar proposals related to the wave functions of Cooper pairs and a superconductor. So there may be ways of generating superpositions of all the Cooper pairs flowing one way in one direction in a squid, one of these superconducting quantum interference devices, and all the Cooper pairs flowing in the opposite direction. So that's another candidate for the kind of quantum state that you use to try to set bounds in these sorts of models. Okay, so I wanted to say something about another model, and then I'll wrap up with some criticisms. So one thing that you might be unhappy about with the Girardi-Rimini-Weber model is this discreteness. You know, the collapses occur once in a while. And you might prefer something that was more continuous. So Philip Pearl, who's one of the guys who's spent his whole career working on collapse theories, has suggested, together with some collaborators in a variety of papers, an alternative to Girardi-Rimini-Weber, wherein collapses are occurring all the time. So I'm not going to go into the details of this model. I can just give you the idea for it. So suppose you have a wave function in a two-dimensional Hilbert space which has just two terms. Rather than saying every once in a while it just collapses completely to one term, this model says that the two terms of the wave function play a kind of game. They evolve according to a particular stochastic Schrodinger equation. But rather than giving you the equation, I'll just sort of tell you what it's like. So there's a game called Gambler's Rune, which works roughly as follows. You have two players, and imagine you know, the sum of their money is $100, but one of them has $80 to start with, the other has $20 to start with. And they, you know, flip a coin. And if it's heads, player A gets a dollar from player B, and if it's tails, it's vice versa. So they just trade dollars back and forth depending on the outcomes of these coin flips. But one of them has a larger reserve of money. And so as you sort of fluctuate back and forth, the game ends, of course, when one of them runs out of money. And so the question is, who's more likely to win the game? Well, the person with $80 is more likely to win because, you know, the fluctuations that will take them down to zero are less frequent than the fluctuations that takes the guy who starts with $20 down to zero. So if you ask what percentage of the time does the guy with $80 win, the answer is 0.8. And the percentage of the time that the guy with $20 wins is 0.2. And so this model basically says two terms of the wave function are like two players that have money A squared and B squared, respectively. The squares are the coefficients in those terms. And the collapses sort of move amplitude back and forth between those two terms rapidly until one of the terms goes to zero. And then, you know, the other term dominates. And because of the result of the gambler's rune experiment, the probability that you'll end up in the first term is just a squared, and the probability you'll end up in the second term is b squared. But the process now is more continuous. You have sort of fluctuations of the levels, so one of them essentially goes to zero. So if you're interested, take a look at papers by Philip Pearl on that. So what are the criticisms? Well, one of the motivations of a realist interpretation was to have some sort of ontology. And people tend to prefer ontologies that happen in space-time, because then we can sort of make sense of it. It's familiar. But you'll note that the wave function, which is assumed to be the complete description of reality in these approaches, doesn't live in space-time. It lives in configuration space. And so it's not the kind of thing that ideally we would want to describe an ontology. If you always collapse it to product states of the particles, each of which is pretty well localized, then you could say, well, there's a sense in which it has a spatial-temporal description. It's just wherever each particle is localized. I can sort of draw a dot there in space-time and say that's roughly what's going on. But people sometimes complain, and this is called the Tales problem, they complain about the fact that those superpositions, like the entangled states, when you suppress one of those peaks, you haven't really taken it to zero because you multiplied by this Gaussian, and the support of the Gaussian is the whole space. So in a sense, all the past history of the wave function with all its features is still there at very low amplitude, and you haven't really eliminated it. And so the ontology is not quite as simple as you might like. There have been some suggestions for what to do about this. So John Bell has a nice idea that maybe if we really wanted a purely spatial-temporal ontology, all we have to do is say those collapse events are all that's real. So remember, in, say, the GRW theory, there was events where, say, the kth particle collapsed to position qk. So imagine there's a flash in space-time at the position qk at the time at which that collapse occurs. And there's a flash in space-time where some other collapse occurs for some other particles. And so if you look at a space-time diagram, you'll just see all these sort of flashes occurring. And Bell's idea was that maybe that's enough. Maybe we can sort of think of the reality of the world we see around us as being defined in terms of just those events, those particular collapse events. And then the fact that the flashes occur probabilistically in accordance with the wave function, and the wave function obeys a kind of projection postulate by the lights of what we've just seen, shows that, roughly speaking, we'll see pointers where they ought to be if everything just depends on the positions of the flashes. So there's a whole debate in the literature about, what is the right ontology for these sorts of models? Should we think of it as just sort of a mass density that's defined by the wave function, or should we think of it in terms of flashes? Another criticism is this failure of energy conservation. So some people like to say, we should try to preserve the fundamental symmetries of our theories. Energy conservation has been something that has been part of every successful empirical theory we've had. So much the worse for this theory if it abandons energy conservation. There's similar issues with Lorentz invariance in this theory as there was in Bowman mechanics. So there has been a lot of work on trying to come up with collapse models for relativistic theories. It's somewhat different from the Bohmian scenario because you have indeterminism in these models. So you need to have a notion of Lorentz invariance for an indeterministic theory. And so there has been some progress in trying to maintain Lorentz invariance, and there's some who argue that it's easier to do here than it is in Bohmian mechanics. But I think it's fair to say that the best proposals are not... it's not clear that they achieve a kind of Lorentz invariance that you'd really want to have. It's not clear that they go far enough. So I'm not going to talk about the details of that, but it's certainly something that people complain about for collapse theories. I mean, we did see that local causality is violated, so there's a failure of relativistic structure in that sense, at least. And then the final point, which I'll spend a little bit more time on, is the following, that suppose you went to the lab and you did find some of this anomalous decoherence. So things, you have a model of what's going on in your experiment, and you think that something's going to evolve unitarily, or at least you think that it's going to decohere at some very small rate, and then you measure the decoherence rate, and you find it's higher. And you've taken into account everything you can, and you say, well, I really can't account for this extra decoherence I'm seeing. Does that vindicate the collapse approach. Well, on the face of it, in a sense it does, because the collapse approach predicts that kind of decoherence. But the problem is that there are alternative ways of explaining it. So let me take you back to the slide where I pointed out that the dynamics that this approach posits is a trace-preserving completely positive map. Right? So this is the case where you don't take account of where the collapse has occurred. And now let me remind you that any one of these maps has a Stein spring dilation. So you'll remember from way back, every density operator has a purification. So this is an entangled state whose reduction is that density operator. Every POVM can be implemented by doing a projective measurement on the system and an ancilla, which is prepared in some pure state. And the relevant case for us, every one of these maps on a system can be implemented by preparing some ancilla in a pure state, unitarily coupling the system to that ancilla, and then forgetting about the ancilla. So this collapse dynamics is no exception. If I went to the lab and I saw a system undergoing this dynamics, even though, as far as I could tell, I had managed to isolate it from any other degree of freedom I know about, I could still say, oh, well, maybe that just means that there's some other degree of freedom that wasn't in our theories previously, but it's out there, and it's coupling to my system in a unitary way, and I'm just seeing the decoherence that's a result of that coupling. So in lieu of positing a fundamental indeterministic new kind of dynamics, I could just say, oh, I must postulate a novel quantum degree of freedom that we hadn't known about before that's coupling into the system, and that's why we're seeing this anomalous decoherence. So that's a way out of, or a way to explain this sort of thing. All right, then, this is the last slide. I just wanted to mention that there are other ideas for how to induce collapses. So the basic idea of these sorts of models is that the rate of collapse for a macroscopic object depends on the number of fundamental constituents. Every particle is undergoing collapses very slowly. If you have enough systems, you'll get the macroscopic object collapsing. But there are other ideas for how to get this sort of balance. You know, microscopic systems should behave unitarily. Macroscopic systems should behave in a collapse dynamic sort of way. So one idea is that it has something to do with gravity. So Roger Penrose has written a lot about a criterion for collapse involving a difference in terms of the wave function corresponding to a single graviton. And then there have also been proposals, for example, by Tony Leggett, that it might have something to do with a measure of entanglement of your overall wave function or the complexity of the overall wave function, which determines whether a collapse is going to occur or not. But as it stands today, none of these